Welcome to Fourth Estate, the show that brings journalists together to discuss the week's big movements in the media world. We're coming to you from the 2SER studios in Sydney on Gadigal Country. My name's Marcus Costello. Coming up tonight, media reform. Communications Minister Mitch Fifield has proposed changes which could spark a flurry of mergers and acquisitions in the troubled traditional media landscape. Talking about mergers and acquisitions, ABC's outgoing managing director Mark Scott thinks it's time ABC and SBS join forces, and the force of evil that is ISIS. Should broadcasters hold back from airing ISIS promotional material? Joining me in the studio, commentator Oz Farooqi. Hello, Oz.
G'day.
And media reporter with Fairfax Media, Max Mason. Hello, Max.
Hello.
And joining us on the line from Brisbane, editor of citizen journalism website No Fibs, Margot Kingston. Hi, Margot.
Hello.
Yesterday, the Sydney Morning Herald's conservative columnist Paul Sheenan issued something of a correction and an apology over a column he penned earlier this week. In that column, Sheenan related the story of a woman he'd spoken to, a woman he calls Louise, who told Paul that she'd been attacked and raped by a gang of Arabic-speaking men in Sydney in 2002. Louise tells Paul, in reporting the incident to police, she was completely ignored. Since Paul's column went to print, Louise has ignored police attempts to reach out to her, and she's now ignoring Paul too. The details of her account don't check out. There aren't hospital records, and her employer can't verify her story. And she's told the story before, at a rally for Reclaim Australia, the anti-Muslim group. Paul now admits that he's probably been had. Margot Kingston, throwing to you, how did this story get past an editor, let alone land on the front page of the Sydney Morning Herald?
Well, I haven't worked for the Herald since 2005, and obviously since then there's been a lot of downsizing, and I assume there's far fewer checks and balances. But the thing about a senior columnist is that, by definition, it's a question of trust. In some ways, they're sort of equal in power to the editors, like very loath to question them. But in this case, it's a red light story. The story just doesn't add up. I mean, how could the police possibly ignore her? How could her employer, the public hospital system, ignore her? How did any of this happen? A guy for the Monthly did a piece saying that he sorted out her lack of bona fides with a 15-minute search. The Herald's correction said that they weren't satisfied as to the fact that it happened, that the police didn't do anything, and that the racial ethnic groups were involved. So, you know, we have really serious questions about the checks and balances, but beyond that, I feel, and this is hard to say as a colleague, and I do know Paul, that I feel as a matter of honour he should have resigned. There wasn't any apology in his correction, and this is just so out there. It was actually promoted on page one of the Herald, so you can't really just blame the journalist, but really this is so bad that I would have thought that rather than the Herald having to sack him, that he should resign.
Oz, this column could have much wider implications. Who has Paul Sheenan let down aside from himself and his colleagues?
I think all the readers and all the journalists and the editors that work at the Herald. But I think what's interesting about this issue, Paul, the only people that Paul Sheen apologised to in his apology column today were the police, who he originally attacked for not acting. In fact, now we know that they didn't act because there was no crime for them to act on. I'm genuinely surprised that no one's been fired as a result of this incident. I understand Margot's point that senior columnists, they've been writing for the paper for years, I think over a decade in his case, and there's a level of trust there. But there's not just the opinion editor who we would work with, there's the editor who makes the decision what to put on the front page. And the fact that they saw that story and they thought, oh, well, this is a bit interesting, I'm not going to look into it a lot further, I'm just going to whack it on the front because hopefully that'll pique people's curiosity and they might buy a copy. I'm not sure if that was the reason, but it seems to be the only logic I can see for putting it there. There's a number of people involved in making that decision, and all we've got as a result of the retraction, the original column is still up there on the website, just with an update that says that, it was wrong. And there's previous columns that Paul Sheehan's written that have been found to be wrong that have been pulled. I'm not really sure why this one is still up there, to be honest. But I think the two groups in specific that probably the most likely to feel the repercussions of this. One, there's the argument that it will feed into this theme that women just make up rape allegations. And we know that's not true. And a lot of news articles that have covered the story today have highlighted that most allegations aren't made up. But then, of course, there's the Muslim community, the Arabic community in Sydney, who were slurred in that piece. And that's not a strong term to use. They were slurred by Paul Sheehan. And no one from the Herald has bothered to apologise to either of those two groups. And I think that's pretty sad.
So on Monday, Cabinet agreed to a package of reforms that includes scrapping the population reach rule so that big fish in the pond can gobble up the small ones and broadcast to more than 75% of the population. Also set to go is the 2 out of 3 rule, where media companies aren't allowed to own a TV station and a radio station and a newspaper in the same market. This sets the scene for mergers between the likes of newspaper publisher Fairfax and television broadcaster Channel 9. Media companies would argue that mergers are essential for them to compete with the growing threat of international media companies like Netflix and Facebook, which don't face the same regulatory burdens or infrastructure costs. Max, why do we need reform?
Well, I think, you know, the laws were written in an age when the internet didn't exist. I mean, Facebook, Netflix, Google were not even a twinkle in the eye when these laws were written. The problem that exists for a lot of regional broadcasters is that they're now facing competition from their metropolitan counterparts. Their metropolitan counterparts are broadcasting over the internet into their areas, which means that viewers can see very, very similar content than what they're offering. So if you're an advertiser going to a regional broadcaster, you're going, well, your content's not exclusive. Why should I pay you as much as I was paying you before? So, because everything comes down to ad dollars. Ad dollars funds the media industry. It funds the internet. So in an age where, you know, the internet has superseded the rules, it's unsurprising that the government has gone for these changes.
Right. So there it's some of the regional players and some of the small cities which might lose out here. Margot, who do you think will be some of the winners and losers if these reforms go through?
Well, to my mind, the abolition of the reach rule is common sense for the reasons that Max gave. And when you can merge the regional players, TV players, with the metropolitan ones, they'll put a condition in there that the regionals continue with local news. So I think that's a win-win. And I'd really like to see that legislation just go through separately, because it should be just waved through. On the 2 out of 3 rule, the Queen of Screen or Prince of Print rule that Paul Keating did, when I was in the game, I fought really hard over many, many years to stop Packer taking over Fairfax, the whole issue of concentration of media ownership. But I am of the opinion now that we really should let that go through to the keeper as well. Like, the fact of the matter is, and this is being led from the US as usual, is that the really big money now is in your Googles and your Amazons, your Facebooks, and they are starting to move into the space. And, for example, Jeff Bezos took over the Washington Post. Apart from those new players, you've got lots of niche players and independent players. We've got, in Australia, we've brought in The Guardian, The Daily Mail, Huffington Post, BuzzFeed. I think that the mainstream media, or legacy media, I suppose you call it now, isn't really as powerful as it was. And I understand that the Rupert Murdoch thing is big, and that it would, him adding a television station and radio would be big. But I think that we've really got to acknowledge reality at this stage and let that one go too. But that's more controversial, and perhaps the government could split the two so that the non-commercial one gets straight through and saves the regional TV players, and maybe a bit more talk and discussion on the concentration one.
Yeah, right. So similar reform has been carried out in Indonesia, where media moguls remain a powerful force in the digital age despite the variety of content made available on the internet. In that context, the big media players got bigger, power was concentrated, and arguably election coverage was biased. So, Oz, how could the narrowing of media ownership impact on the way politics is covered here in Australia?
It's a good question, and that's obviously the counter-argument to abolishing the 2 out of 3 rule. You know, we might see more less diversity effectively and more concentration in terms of who runs a media. Just as a quick aside, it's kind of interesting that finally Turnbull's now the guy who's abolishing this rule as Prime Minister. Margot mentioned the Kerry Packer bid for Fairfax. I think Turnbull is actually Kerry Packer's legal advisor and senior counsel during that bid. So this is kind of like a 20-year project, for him. I'm kind of two minds when it comes to media diversity. Actually, like when we talk about media diversity, we sometimes pretend that we're talking about political diversity, that there's this genuine like idea that media organizations represent significantly different ideologies and that's all part of the marketplace of ideas. Really what we're talking about is different rich people, generally rich middle-aged white guys owning media organizations. So is it diverse because, Gina Reinhart currently has a stake in Fairfax or had a stake in Fairfax? Sorry, had a stake in Fairfax. and obviously Rupert Murdoch owns News Corp. Say hypothetically Rupert Murdoch owned everything and Gina Reinhart owned everything. I'm not that convinced that would be like the end of the media landscape, given the most interesting things that are happening in contemporary media space are from new players and digital players in particular. And I think, I guess I've changed my view from being someone who really wanted to protect media diversity the way that it's currently operated to saying media organizations are fighting over scraps in terms of the legacy media organizations, and the only way we're going to get genuine diversity is by replicating what's happened, particularly in the States, where new players like Vox have emerged, and we've got BuzzFeed and Daily Mail operating in Australia. I think that's where we're going to get diversity.
So right. Can I just add something? I think you also need to give the journalists credit. Think about, and I'm not spruiking my own company here, when Gina Reinhart bought into the company, we didn't give her a board seat because she wouldn't sign the editorial charter of independence. And eventually she sold out of the company for her own reasons, but it's basically because she couldn't control the media, even though she owned a large chunk of it. And this was in an age when print media is struggling. Print revenues are going down, so give to the journalists some credit as well.
I think that's actually a really good point. I think even the Australian, which people deride as being this right wing bastion of news, the opinion section, I personally think, is not that great. But there are really good journalists there who are clearly not right wing. They're just independent journalists working hard. So I think whether it's Reinhart or Packer or whoever, it's not as though journalists will stop being journalists. They'll keep doing their jobs.
You're listening to Fourth Estate with me, Marcus Costello, and I'm talking with Max Mason, Oz Faruqi and Margot Kingston about what happened in media affairs this week. The ABC's outgoing managing director, Mark Scott, has called for a grown-up conversation about merging the nation's two public broadcasters, ABC and SBS. He argues it could save the federal government $40 million of the $1.3 billion spent on public broadcasting each year. How? Well, by sharing operating costs and auctioning off broadcast spectrum they wouldn't need if they worked together. So this isn't a merger of ABC and SBS brands. Scott thinks we're doubling up on buildings and studios, IT, legal affairs, finance, HR, corporate divisions, and all the other support services required to make content. Although no official statements have been made, it seems likely kids and youth affairs programming might be shifted to online channels to free up some of that very lucrative broadcast spectrum. Margot, if it's just a matter of selling off broadcast spectrum and cutting down on the HR, IT payroll and flogging some real estate, should content creators be concerned? Is this really an issue for journalism?
I'm a really, really big opponent of this. If you look at what Mark's suggesting, it's same building, same studio and technology, same legals, same finance, same HR, same corporate affairs and same board. To me, that's not combining back office, that's takeover. It's that simple. The ABC has wrongly, in my opinion, been totally predatory of SBS. I mean, their job is to get the broadest range, all of the charter things, but what justification is there for them putting Foreign Correspondent up against Dateline? What justification is there for it outbidding SBS? I mean, it has acted in relation to SBS as a competitor instead of a complementary broadcaster. And to my mind, this back office so-called thing is a takeover, and that means less diversity. And at a time when we're arguing diversity, you need to have different creative teams, different charter obligations, different outlooks to promote that diversity. I'll just give you one example. A doco that I've been involved in recently is telling the story of the Pauline Hanson years. The producer couldn't get any interest at all from the ABC and got an enthusiastic response from SBS. Now, you just can't tell me that with that whole effective merger that there wouldn't be ABC deciding what's what and that's it. I just think it's really wrong. I mean, the SBS is the most exciting channel on TV, in my opinion. It is edgy, as Mitch Fifield said. It is nervy. It is groundbreaking. And once you move the whole thing into that ABC sphere, I feel there's no doubt that it would get smothered.
You say it's edgy and groundbreaking. I don't think that Mark Scott would disagree with you on that point, only that he thinks that you can consume that content online. I mean, he has said that, quote, SBS was created well before digitisation, well before digital television. It's an analog solution in a digital world. He's saying that anyone who wants foreign language content can find it online. I wonder if there are surely still Australians who enjoy SBS TV and radio content in its many languages and who don't use the internet very often or very well. So, Oz, should taxpayers continue to pay for the analog content to service this share of the market who perhaps haven't migrated across to online?
It's funny. I mean, the ABC was also created before the advent of the internet. So it's a weird criticism, I think, for Scott to make. I've actually got pretty strong feelings about this, that I don't think Margot's put the case well, why people should be concerned. You know, on one hand, Scott is saying, oh, look, it's just back office functions. But he did go as far to say that they might retain separate charters, but the board would be one and the same, right? And look at the current board of the ABC. There's 9 members. All of those 9 members are from an Anglo-Australian background. Now, the SBS was created specifically to reflect cultural diversity across Australia. Do we think that that is going to be retained if the ultimate governing board of the organisation doesn't reflect cultural diversity in Australia? I think that's unlikely to happen. I think people would be more willing to see a stronger relationship, potentially even a merger between the ABC and SBS, if the ABC had shown any inkling over the last decade to actually reflect cultural diversity. And I'm sorry to put it quite bluntly, I think the ABC has absolutely let down Australia in this regard. Only 8% of content makers at the ABC, according to their own diversity report, come from a non-English speaking background. And that compares to a figure of 17% for the entire country. So the ABC effectively is 50% underrepresentative of Australia's cultural diversity, and that's a big issue. When we look at the ABC board, you look at ABC management, it's even less representative than their content makers. And I think that's the fear, that if the SBS is subsumed by the ABC, which is what would happen in a merger because they're smaller, that the focus on telling the important stories might get lost. Now, there are probably savings to be made on things like the spectrum, but what I find interesting is someone like Mark Scott should be an advocate for public broadcasting is instead making a case about savings of $30 to $40 million in the grand scheme of things is nothing. Like, we give $10 billion over the Ford estimates to fossil fuel subsidies. We have corporations that earn billions of dollars in revenue that don't pay any tax at all. Why are we wasting time talking about $30 and $40 million that could be saved by merging back office functions?
It's interesting the point you make there about reflecting Australian stories back to us, that it's not simply a matter of if you don't speak English or if you want content from another country, you can go online and find that.
That's right. It's not just about creating niche programs. It's just, I love The Family Law, and I think more television like that would be great, for example. But it's not just about shows that are specifically about reflecting cultural diversity. It should just be there. Like, when we turn on the news, our journalists and reporters should reflect what the country looks like. The people that commission programs should reflect what the country looks like. And at the moment, the ABC isn't really doing that.
Right. Well, Michael Abid is still strident about SBS remaining as it is and sticking to its charter. He announced this week that SBS will be trialling for 1 year a 24-hour Arabic news radio channel called SBS Arabic 24. He said, quote, particularly given global events in the last decade, the growing concern around youth radicalisation and fundamentalism, this channel, I think, will provide a great opportunity for Australian Arabic communities to come together. Reading between the lines here, some people have interpreted Abid's announcement as SBS's effort to de-radicalise young men in Australia. Mm. After all, he made the announcement in Parliament House. On the other hand, it might simply be saying that Australia's Arabic community is growing, so SBS needs to provide for them. But do Arabic Australians actually want Arabic content? Oz, What's your take on this? Is SBS just doing this to signal to the government that it's an asset worth funding in the fight against terrorism?
I think that's probably what they're doing, and I think that's why Abid would have mentioned radicalisation generally. The weird thing, though, is that the group that is most likely at risk of radicalisation, young people from the Arabic community, from the Muslim community, most of them don't speak Arabic. So a 24-hour Arabic language network seems a bit mistargeted. I think it's important to have one. I think it's great. It'd be great if we had 24-hour broadcasting in lots of languages. And SBS Radio, which does run 24 hours in Punjabi, Hindi, Urdu, Mandarin, Cantonese, is great and much needed. It's an important way for people to engage, you know, with civic society in Australia. But I think let's focus on why it's important in terms of telling stories and giving people the news and not try and conflate that with a de-radicalisation agenda.
A soon-to-be-released research paper by the Lowy Institute says news organisations should ignore Islamic State propaganda or clearly flag it as such in TV broadcasts. That's videos like the one featuring Adelaide doctor Tariq Kalmay, who went to Syria to work for ISIS. The slick video shows Kalmay tending to babies in a neonatal unit. Then there are the videos aimed at boys that make out as if joining the ISIS armed forces is like stepping into a video game. And then there's the really brutal stuff, the beheading videos. Do you think broadcasting or reusing any material produced by ISIS serves to validate them or enhance their brand? Margot, I'll throw that question to you.
All the evidence seems to be that the people who are radicalised, they're doing it online and they're doing it through social media. They're not really, you know, they're not really big mainstream media news watchers. I remember a little while ago, I don't know if you remember this, but they had there was a video where this guy urged supporters to go into Westfield shopping centres and blow them up and to kill Frank Lowy. And that was broadcast on the nightly news, and I just sort of fell into shock. I just thought, well, look, that's just an incitement. I mean, how can that possibly be broadcast? You really have to, I think, just take into account the law and your responsibilities as a media group. If there is a video that is inciting violence, I just can't see why you'd run it.
Right.
The reason you'd run it is, I mean, I think ISIS is well aware of the state of Western media and that we're in a clickbait phase and that this is the sort of thing that we'll rate. And I think we really need to be very careful where we go. I reckon plant ISIS propaganda as a title, but I think we've got to go a bit deeper than that. And when this stuff is actually inciting people to do things, I just don't think we should run it at all.
Right. Max, what about you? What do you think? Even if videos produced by ISIS were to be watermarked with a propaganda tag when broadcast by the media, is that effective in neutralising any problematic impacts? I mean, what happened to there being no such thing as bad publicity?
I mean, I think you still run the risk of giving ISIS what they want. I mean, you're showing their propaganda videos that, you know, propaganda in the name. It's selling their version of the world to somebody else. As a media organisation, you have to think about your responsibility as, you know, am I going to go for these extra hits that maybe might sell me an ad in a month's time? Or am I going to, you know, hold back and, you know, be responsible? But also, I might be putting someone else at danger by showing this. I don't know who's in the video, who's going to be watching the video, how is it going to impact them. These are all things that need to be thought about rather than, you know, whether that story is going to get, you know, 100,000 clicks or, you know, 100,000 people are going to tune into the news to watch that. It's, you know, I think you need to think about the consequences of, you know, broadcasting that kind of thing. I mean, would you think about, you know, there's an extreme example going back to, say, Nazi Germany, were you going to, you know, is the British government going to broadcast a bunch of Nazi propaganda? Think about it in that way.
Right. And I guess given that Google and Twitter say that they will take down content that is explicit like that, they are waiting for actors to call up and say, this is my son, I don't want this up there, and they'll act. But for a lot of people, there isn't that privilege to call up and say, this content shouldn't be there. Well, that's it from us on Fourth Estate. You've been listening to Max Mason, Oz Faruqi and Margot Kingston. So thank you all for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
And don't forget, you can subscribe to Fourth Estate on iTunes. Follow us on Twitter and, you know, like us on Facebook, maybe. My name's Marcus Costello, and you can catch us same time next week.